VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Welcome to The Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti with all the latest from the world of football. This week, I'm joined by Paddy Barkley, Ollie Kay, and Alison Rudd. We'll focus on the big matches soon, but first, we thought we should discuss the sudden and tragic death of Gary Speed, the Wales manager and former Leeds, Everton, Newcastle, Bolton, and Sheffield United midfielder. I guess most of us heard the news at some point on Sunday morning. Gary Speed was 42 years old. He was found hanged in his home. Nothing suspicious, no suggestion of foul play from the police, and obviously, I guess we can all ask us questions. But I wanted to start with you, Ollie. You covered Wales for several years. At the time, he was a captain. What do you remember about Speed in terms of how he related to others and the kind of person he was?
Well, he was very much the leader of that squad, a really good Wales squad at the time under Mark Hughes. And, people will look at the other names that were in there, and Ryan Giggs and Craig Bellamy, and John Hartson was a fairly big player at the time. But it's, Speed was very much the leader, the one that they all looked up to, the one that all the guys in the press looked up to. And he just had this sort of great aura about him, and as a new reporter going into that scene, I mean, he was the one who everybody sort of really looked up to, almost more than Giggs in some ways. He sort of had this statesman-like quality about him in a way that you don't really expect footballers to have. He looked sort of very comfortable in, it still sounds stupid, but he looked very comfortable in a blazer and tie and suit and tie, and he just seemed to have this remarkably confident, assured, mature nature that most footballers don't have. And that was the way he played as well. He was very confident, very brave, very disciplined, very clever. He was a kind of footballer that British footballers produced all too rarely in recent years.
I mean, I guess, Paddy, for me, Gary Speed is a bit unusual because he sort of bridged the gap between the time I was in school before going to university, when I was living here in the late 80s and early 90s, when he was sort of this young midfielder for that Leeds United team. And that was really one of my first sort of memories after moving to this country, that midfield with McAllister, David Batty, that's right.
And Gordon Strachan.
And Gordon Strachan, yeah, and Speed. And, and I guess it was Chapman and Carl Schutt up front, as I recall, and White and...
Mel Sterland.
Mel Sterland, I mean...
spectrum.
Chris Fairclough, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how that
John McClelland.
Yeah, but it's quite remarkable. And John Lukic in goal. It's amazing how, I mean, for me, I wasn't living in Leeds. There's no real reason to remember that Leeds side. Remember, this is before they actually won the title. But I just remember those sort of left-footed guy powering around the pitch. And then years later, you know, I go off to university, go to graduate school, I come back to this country, I work in this sport, and Gary Speed is sort of always there, always playing. I mean, I believe at one point, he held the record for most Premier League appearances. Yes, and I know football didn't begin in 1991, but still, you know, he played more games in the Premier League than anybody in the last 20 years, and he was an outfield player at the time. I believe it's since been broken, but it's quite remarkable.
Yes. Well, he was, you could talk about Gary Speed as a footballer forever, because during his career, during his tragically curtailed life, we hardly ever talked about him. I've never known a player of such class so taken for granted. And I think that was because he was the antithesis of the kind of footballer we've come to associate with the deteriorating image of the game, the people we now call characters. You hardly ever read about Speed other than that he'd played excellently the day before. And the other thing about him is, you talked about that championship winning Leeds team in 1992, and how he was part of that perfectly balanced midfield, and Howard Wilkinson used him on the left very much for his aerial ability as much as anything else. He was young at that time, and yet we thought of him as a mature player. And he continued to be mature until he retired at probably stopped playing 38, 39, I don't know. During that time, as Howard Wilkinson pointed out in a very moving tribute on Sky Television yesterday before the Swansea match, very brave of Howard. I mean, clearly it was difficult for him, because Howard was one of the people who actually loved Speed as a man. He said that, you know, he'd played him in virtually every position except goalkeeper, and you suddenly remembered. Yes, he played as the wide left sort of Ray Kennedy style midfield player. But he ended up as a brilliant fullback as well. He could play as a brilliant fullback. And then he ended up running the game from central midfield. He could do everything, but he did it quietly, and he did it in an exemplary fashion. I know people have said this before, but he truly was the perfect professional.
Alison?
I didn't know him. I interviewed him when he just joined Everton 15 years ago. And I remember I wrote at the time he was like a comic book hero. He's got the name Gary Speed. If you're going to make up a the perfect football, you'd call him something like Gary Speed. And what struck me was, you see, and I mean, we don't know. I suspect having the word perfect applied to you all the time is not a good thing in life generally. But he's perfectly polite. And it seemed to me whenever he moved clubs, he always did so in the perfect way. It wasn't for self-aggrandizement. It was always done thoughtfully and with regret that he was leaving behind people that he cared for. I don't think you'll find many players who shift clubs as thoughtfully as Gary Speed would do. And I can only echo what Paddy said, really, is that because he was just so good at doing what his managers wanted him to do, he was never the headline act. You know, he did the role unflinchingly, never moaned, and sometimes he could play really, really well, and he wouldn't be the player you thought of afterwards as being the star player, but you know perfectly well the result wouldn't have happened without him.
Ollie, I guess we sort of think back, and you know, we can all think of athletes who died prematurely. There's obviously no shortage of examples from boxing, and obviously racing, but it seems to me in football and in the last few years, obviously, you know, you think of Robert Enke, you think of Gianluca Pesotto, the former Juventus fullback during the World Cup. You think of the referee Babacar Fati, who attempted to commit suicide, and there was another case in Belgium this past weekend. Is there something broader here? Is it just that you know, these things sort of stick out, and we're maybe unused to them in football, of people being taken so young.
I think in a lot of the instances you mentioned, you know, depression was the thing, and we don't know whether that was the case with Gary Speed, and we'd probably rather not speculate. But whatever there was, a guy who clearly seemed to have it all and seemed to have dozens and dozens and dozens of friends, and, well, hundreds and hundreds of friends in football, and a brilliant family life, seemingly, clearly felt alone enough to do that and helpless enough to do that. I've no idea why and what the catalyst would be, and in some ways I don't want to know, but I think it just shows you and reminds you. It was something somebody said to me recently about when I was talking to the Robert Enke book about it. They said something. The line was something like, "You know, you'll never get another industry where everything is so close knit in a working environment, yet every employee, every player is so isolated from each other. It doesn't seem like." I mean, probably rambling off in another direction here, but it doesn't seem like there's a great willingness in football from people to look to each other for help off the pitch. I would guess that would probably be said of society as a whole, but I think there's I think the more and more cases that we hear, whether it's players with depression or other vices or this kind of terrible news regarding Gary Speed, I think there is a growing trend where people, despite seeming to have it all in their lives, do feel isolated and do feel alone in, you know, when we don't expect them to.
Paddy, I'll give you the last word on this.
Yes, all I would say is that Gary Speed, as far as Gary Speed is concerned, that his family have rightly asked for privacy, and I certainly intend to respect that. So I don't have any interest in that beyond sadness.
Yeah, I think that's something that we can all share. Speed's passing, of course, was marked with a moment's silence at in Swansea, ironically in Wales, the first match on Sunday. But we're going to focus on first on the second match Sunday at Anfield, Liverpool against Manchester City. Alison, I'm going to begin with you, because when I saw the lineup, and obviously Doug Leash's options were slightly limited, of course. Craig Bellamy, very close to Speed, asked not to be selected or wasn't selected.
Well, Doug Leash decided not to pick him.
Yeah, which I think understandable given the circumstances. I was wondering whether, especially in the first half hour or so, whether it seemed to you that Liverpool were perhaps a little more cautious than you expected before coming forward. Is that an opinion you share, and was that part of the game plan?
Yes. For the opening passages of play, Liverpool did look like the away team, not the home team. If you set up 4-5-1, that is a cautious formation. And I think Liverpool get away with it, and indeed got away with it on Sunday, because the one is Suarez, and I can't really think of another player who you could play a packed midfield with one up front and it working as well. If it wasn't someone, I mean, his energy levels are absolutely phenomenal, and he makes the defence, the opposition defence, think more than if there were two players playing up front. I would like to see, I don't think it would work at all if it was 4-5-1 for Liverpool and the one, who could it possibly be? Who could it possibly be? Kaut maybe has that energy level, but not quite the trickery or the finishing ability. Certainly wouldn't work with someone like Carroll. That would be plain stupid. So I think it did look cautious, but it worked. I'd like to think that was the grand plan that Doug Leash knew all along. It would sort of evolve into being actually quite an attack-minded and almost audacious approach. And by the end, I felt that City were pummeled.
Ollie, did you share that assessment, or were City pummeled at the end largely because they were down to 10 men?
I thought Liverpool were the better team once they scored on 32 minutes. I thought they particularly in the opening, particularly in the closing stages when City were down to 10 men and I thought were visibly, clearly tiring after their midweek exertions. They looked, they did look a little jaded, although they could have won it on the break with Silva. I thought Liverpool were the better team overall and slightly hard done by. I thought Joe Hart made a couple of brilliant saves and a couple of very good ones as well. And I didn't have a problem with Liverpool's approach. It's fairly normal really to play one up front or 4-3-3, 4-5-1, call it what you like, at home these days. And I thought they had the best outfield player on the pitch in Lucas Leiva.
Yeah, I want to follow up on Lucas because, Paddy, I can think of few players who got as much abuse as he did during his first time. And I think, I'm not going to name names, but anybody can go and Google and we can see all the awful things that many people wrote about Lucas Leiva and by extension Benitez as well for signing him. But right now in that position, there aren't many who are playing better in the Premier League.
No, I don't think there are any. I think he's the best holding midfield player, one of the best. He must be one of the best in Europe. It's an area in which the Barclays Premier League is very weak, but not at Liverpool. And I think he's playing now that role better, possibly, than Mascherano used to. Although Mascherano had the considerable help of Xabi Alonso. So I just cannot speak highly enough of him. His reading of the game, his tackling, which was poor before. I mean, we weren't talking nonsense, the critics were, but saying he was poor. He was poor. His tackling was impetuous, often silly, often a boon to the opposition in terms of free kicks close to goal. It's now absolutely exemplary. You could make a video out of him and give it to English midfield players because we need, in England, the national team needs a holding midfield player more than just about anything else. So you just can't speak highly enough of him. Liverpool, I'd just like to say, I mean, they have now played in recent weeks Manchester United, Chelsea and Manchester City. They haven't always won, but they've always been slightly the better side. Against all three. So if I was a Liverpool fan, I'd be feeling very, very happy and I wouldn't worry too much about tactical issues. They've been the better side in all of those games. So they're now competitive with anybody.
But one tactical issue, I think, is... if you're playing Man United and Chelsea and Manchester City, they will come at you and you can play the way Liverpool play. If you're playing a team that are more conservative, where do the goals come from? Mm.
Yeah, and I think that's the one thing that Doug Leash will still be working on. And Ollie, I want to get your view on this because, you know, we mentioned, we praised Suarez and Lucas, but I look at this and I wonder, okay, is there an alternative to either Lucas and Suarez? In other words, a guy who can do Lucas's job in midfield or a guy who can do Suarez's job or some impersonation thereof, without having to change a tactical approach entirely. Because obviously, yeah, if Suarez is missing, then in comes Carroll, but then it's a very different team with Carroll in there. And I'd suggest the same goes for Lucas.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've not got an abundance of strikers. Obviously, there's Carroll, there's Kout as well, and there's and in midfield, they've got... Well, they have got an abundance of central midfielders, but they've not got another one like Lucas. I just wonder if Lucas misses any games, or you know, whether it's injury, suspension, whatever, or just needs a rest. Then maybe Gerrard or Henderson could sit slightly. But
you have to change everything, wouldn't you, to accommodate a different style of player?
Yeah, but I mean, it's probably a mark of Lucas's improvement that we're talking in those terms about him. But I mean, just going back slightly, I don't think he's been some kind of overnight success. I think he's been Liverpool's best player in both of the previous two seasons, under Benitez and then under Hodgson initially and Dalglish. So he's played pretty well for a pretty long time. But he is now at a real peak in terms of his performance levels.
Talked about Andy Carroll before. It goes back to this. I mean, maybe we are influenced by his price tag or his age, but it strikes me that And he's not where he is in terms of, or Dalglish isn't where he is in terms of having Carroll be a functional part of this Liverpool side. It seems to me that when he comes on, Liverpool's approach changes because of the big man. And for that reason, you know, you really only see him 15, 20 minutes at a time. And it's sort of like the old sort of Peter Crouch, or chuck him on. And then all of a sudden Liverpool go from playing being a side that plays a certain way to being a side that plays a different way. Do you see Carroll actually integrating with Suarez, maybe with Suarez moving to the wing or whatever? Is there a way to do that? And is the onus on Kenny for finding a scheme to accommodate that? Or is the onus primarily on Carroll for you know, not asking the ball, not asking for the ball up high? Because he can't, I mean, I think he does have the skills to be more multidimensional.
I think even in the current game, you don't pay $35 million for a substitute. And I think that that Carroll, on some of the form he displayed in his better games at Newcastle, was not big man up front. I mean, he was that, but he was everything else as well. Quick enough, fantastic finisher, decent vision, though perhaps that is something you would hope would improve with time. I don't know what has gone wrong with his physical condition at all, but there's obviously something badly wrong that he doesn't start games. But I don't think it'd be necessary at all to change the... I mean, Suarez is an exceptional player. I can't remember anybody since Kevin Keegan, funnily enough, who at the same club, who works defences the way he does in every possible way, including dark ways. You know, that he's such a cheat, but he is the worst I've ever. He has every trick. He doesn't just dive. He works the linesman. He works the referee. He's an absolute pest. But that's why he's so good. But I you know. He and Carroll definitely can play together. Let's just hope that from England.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Point of view as well, that something happens to get back that mobility that Carroll on his better days at Newcastle showed and looked like being the complete centre forward.
It's the old conundrum though, isn't it? I mean, Andy Carroll is only going to re-blossom. I mean, I think people were fating him when he was at Newcastle. You know, he's not come from nowhere. You're only going to re-blossom if he's given match time, and that's the balance that Dalglish has to get right, because if there's something wrong with his conditioning, it's of the level, I think, that he needs match fitness, not sitting on the bench fitness.
It was interesting, just after the game yesterday, I was in the press box at Anfield working away, and the Liverpool unused substitutes and other squad members were sort of having a warm down and a bit of a training session ahead of the Carling Cup game at Chelsea, and I was watching Carroll. I had a particular eye on him, and you know, they were knocking crosses in for him, and quite often the ball would bounce up in front of him, and he would just sort of shin it over the crossbar like a Sunday League centre forward. And he clearly seems to be struggling with some sort of confidence issue. And you know, it's not surprising really after struggling to make the impact he would have liked. But then I remember he lined up a free kick about 30 yards from goal. I don't think I've ever seen him take a free kick. And he just absolutely thrashed it with his left foot right into the top corner, and the goal shuddered even though it hit the net. It was he's got something about him, but in general play, I think when he has to sort of control the ball or lay it off or whatever, I think he looks sluggish at the moment, and he looks like he lacks confidence, but he needs games clearly.
It's a shame in a way that they you don't send a 35 million player out on loan, but he could really benefit from that. Just go somewhere, be the main man, get all that back.
Just to touch upon another young striker who cost some 12, 13 million pounds less than Andy Carroll, but who makes probably even more headlines for things he does off the pitch. Mario Balotelli is sent off, two yellows, elbow and skirt. I sort of watched on Twitter, including you, Oliver K. Times,
about, he
gets himself sent off again. I watched it again with the benefit of many replays, and I'm thinking to myself, how is this any different from what Alan Shearer did just about every minute of every game during his career? And was this a situation where, you know, maybe we're being a little bit too hard on him? The first yellow, there's no question about it. You know, it was silly, but this second one, I thought, was he a bit hard done by, or am I just using my blue tinted glasses again?
Yeah, well, in what way was I harsh on him? In what way? I merely reported the fact that he'd been sent off, and the soap opera continues. That's not saying that he's.
Okay, I'm not suggesting you're a
bad
being
guy.
Right. I'm not suggesting.
However, there are completely different rules now to when Alan Shearer was playing. Generally, if you challenge for a ball with your arm up near an opponent's head or face or neck or whatever, you are in danger of getting a yellow card. And you know, there's no, you know, this thing of if you raise your hand you get sent off is a complete myth, or a sort of it's become a bit of a cliche. But generally, if you've already been booked, it's pretty unwise to go for a challenge like that. I've got sympathy with him, but not, you know, not as much sympathy as Mancini had. I thought I saw Mancini sort of remonstrate with him when he came towards the bench after being sent off, and I thought Mancini was protecting him in what he said afterwards. I would imagine Mancini would in some way be frustrated with him for inviting that second yellow card in today's game.
He was. He hadn't seen the. I mean, I can explain that. He hadn't seen the replay yet, and so he thought, like, "Oh, Mario, you're being stupid again." And plus, Mario was very angry at being sent off. He thought that Skrtel had made a meal of it. But that seems to be a growing trend, by the way. Big tall people with shaved heads who look hard, and you know, sort of the Mark Tierney school of play acting. But I want to leave you with one final thought, Patty. If you're Mancini, in the end, yeah, you're annoyed because Balotelli got sent off, but a point at Anfield on the same weekend that United, who we're going to get to in a minute, dropped 2 points at home against Newcastle, your glass is half full, right?
Mine would be half empty. I think that I know we've paid tribute to Liverpool and rightly so, but Manchester City, with the players they have, should be winning those games. And I thought they should have been two up before Liverpool settled. They should have been two up City. They did, to be fair, they did start with a very, very high tempo, playing one-touch football, which was clearly designed to make chances. It did. They didn't take them. I would say, yes, the result is okay. 1-1 at Liverpool, given that Liverpool are a good team this season. But I think Manchester City really should have done better. I was disappointed. For the first time this season, I thought this team might not win the league.
Moving on to Old Trafford, United and Newcastle. pretty much just get Newcastle all the way. We talked about how, you know, they had this brilliant start and they were going to be tested. Then once they played sort of City and United, and they've got Chelsea next. But I kind of feel so far so good. Although Sir Alex Ferguson is rather angry over that Rio Ferdinand tackle, which led to the penalty kick, and he went so far as to suggest that the linesman should not be officiating again, which I guess we'll find out this week if he's in trouble. Allison, yeah, I'm looking at you. You know why? You're the qualified referee. Can you say that the referee got it completely wrong and Sir Alex, once again, is completely right?
Well, you're only going to say the referee got it completely wrong if you accept that the referee should overrule what his assistant tells him.
The assistant got it completely wrong.
Well, the assistant did get, you know, you say this every time. He got it wrong because we've seen it several times on a slow-mo replay. The thing is, regardless of whether it had been a fair tackle, and it was a fair tackle, it was actually one of the best tackles I've seen Ferdinand make in ages. It was really well timed. It was really well timed. It was a sort of tackle you'd show people on a video how to be a good defender under pressure.
didn't use the trailing leg at all. It was
very
exemplary.
Very clean. But the point is, even if it had been quite a poor tackle, Rio would have said it was fine, and Ferguson would have slated the officials anyway.
Correct.
So there's a bit of crying wolf and fire and all that nonsense going on. So we ought to be very sympathetic to Ferguson. That his team played very well, and they were undone by a poor decision. But they're so rare. Poor decisions are so rare at Old Trafford anyway. So I don't blame the referee. This is not... At the amateur level, as a referee, you are told to take complete control of the game and ignore your assistants because you're not sure what calibre they are, what the motivations are. They're often people who come from one of the clubs. They're biased and so on. And so you see it all the time, amateur level, referees completely ignoring the flag on the touchline. At this high Premier League level, one of the top games in the world happening this weekend, it would be poor, I think, for a referee to ignore a man that he is part of his team, he trusts him, he's close to the action, and he's telling him, I definitely saw that as a foul. So I don't blame the referee at all. And who knows, from the angle that the assistant was standing, it may have looked like he also took the player.
Fergie changed it again in midfield. And, I mean... I like squad rotation. I like the fact that he's embraced it. I think he's taken it a bit far this season. Do you think, and you know, he might make the point that Anderson and Cleverley are out, but, you know, you're talking about Anderson and Cleverley here, you know, you're not talking about sort of Brian Robson and Glenn Hoddle, and here I'm dating myself.
Remy Moses.
Pardon?
Remy Moses.
There you go. But is this counterproductive at this stage, do you think, that this constant chopping and changing, and Rooney's in midfield and Rooney's in up front, and this one comes in and that one goes out and Darren Fletcher disappears and this one reappears?
Well,
has anybody actually, and also in answering that, has anybody had the opportunity to sit down and ask him? I don't subscribe to MUTV, so I don't know.
No, you know how limited opportunities to sit down and ask Fergie.
But I would have thought, he might have explained it. He likes talking about football.
Yeah, well, supposedly, apart from when you're asking genuine questions. But instinctively, I think most people would say, yeah, that there is no continuity. There's, you know, he's chopping and changing. He's not found a winning formula. But if you go back two or three seasons to when United were... absolutely dominant for a period in mid-season where I think they conceded, went something like 13, 14 games without conceding a goal. He was changing the defence every game to game. You know, it was a completely new central defensive partnership, completely new fullbacks every game, it seemed, completely new central midfield partnership. Sometimes he'd change the goalkeeper as well, Van der Sar, Kuchek, whatever. And I think it's basically about... You know, I think that shows that it can work, but I'm just not convinced by the quality of the individuals in this United squad. We all know that the collective adds up to something substantial with United, but the United central midfielders I like Carrick, but he's not really played well or consistently for 2.5 years. Giggs is, what, 37, or is he 38 now? Anderson I've never been a fan of. Fletcher has not played well over the last year or two, probably because of this illness and struggling to shake it off. And Tom Cleverley, in his absence, has been built up to be sort of Brian Robson and Roy Keane and Paul Scholes combined, which just shows the desperation. You said Jones in the midfield sometimes, Rooney in midfield sometimes. I mean, that midfield is not... those players are not players that you would think are going to be... winning the Champions League with that midfield. It's just, I don't think it's necessarily the chopping and changing. I think it's the individuals. I just don't think they are good enough to find to form a central midfield partnership that is going to work week after week after week to achieve all that United want to achieve.
Time now for some quick hits. Andre Villas-Boas was reportedly under fire, but Chelsea beat up on Wolves 3-0 at the weekend. So, Ollie, does that mean that AVB has nothing to worry about now? And what do you make of the fact that Fernando Torres has been on the bench for 3 consecutive games?
I think it's actually 4 consecutive games with Torres. And it,
I stand corrected.
And it's almost reached the stage where that news barely meets a shrug when the teams are read out. He is really struggling. But he has become, I mean, he's not the least of the problems, but he's become a relatively minor problem compared to the overall picture at Chelsea, which isn't good. Results aren't good, and they're not. The overall pitch isn't changed by one win against a poor Wolves team. They need a really good run and to put this bad moment, as Carlo Ancelotti would call it, behind them.
I was at that game, and I can confirm it was a horrible day for Wolves, which just started badly with conceding that early goal and went downhill from there. At the Emirates, Arsenal huffed and puffed, but couldn't blow down Martignol's house. In fact, when Thomas Vermaelen got the equaliser at the end, the relief was palpable. Paddy, is this a case of Arsenal playing poorly, Fulham playing well, or perhaps something else entirely?
Well, it was certainly Fulham played well. I was there. It was a very high-class game of football, actually. I thoroughly enjoyed every second of it. I don't think it's a case of Arsenal playing poorly at all. I think it's just a case of if Robin Van Persie doesn't score at the moment, nobody else is going to score many.
Well, certainly not Arshavin, who got a rare start out on the wing. Mm. Don't look now, but Spurs keep marching on. If they win their game in hand, they'll pass Manchester United and move into second place. Alisson, they won at West Brom at the weekend without Luka Modric and Raphael van der Vaart. Might they be the real challengers to City?
They might. The only problem is their game is so high tempo. It's so based on energy and sort of swamping the opposition, and they are a delight to watch because of that, but that's quite a difficult approach to sustain through the whole season, but they do have a fairly large squad, and those two players that were missing are the two best players in the team, so it's certainly looking good.
Yeah, West Brom's defence didn't exactly pull up trees in that one either. But credit to Tottenham. Stoke defeat Blackburn 3-1, but those grumpy stewards at the Britannia remove a banner calling for Rovers boss Steve Keane to be sacked. Ollie, were they a bit overzealous here? Given that it's the supporters who pay Keane's wages, do they not have a right to air their views with a nice civil banner reading Keane out?
Yeah, I can't see any harm whatsoever in that banner.
Also, it's Stoke, right? It's not like they were saying Pulis out. What do you care?
Absolutely. It's it's fairly bewildering. I'm sure they'd trot out some kind of health and safety explanation. But, I mean, the Steve Keane situation, it is baffling. I interviewed him recently and sort of asked him various slightly uncomfortable questions. I think he's got plenty to offer as a manager and as a coach, but of course his job should be on the line after whatever it is, three wins in 27 games, and for the board at Blackburn to give him a new contract in defiance of those supporters. Obviously they don't have to pay attention to everything the fans say, but to give him a new contract is just bewildering and raises more questions than answers, and I find that whole situation very uncomfortable.
I never understood the economics. I thought in a free market the whole point was don't pay somebody to do a job more than he would do the job for. So if he'll do the job for $500,000, pay him $500,000. Why you got to give him more money? Does it make him a better manager?
Well, he's getting a good Premier League manager's contract, and I would say that he would have probably done it for very, very little when he was off the job nearly 12 months ago. It's bewildering.
Neil Warnock is annoyed, and not just because QPR lost 2-1 at Norwich. His two first-choice goalkeepers are injured, and the Premier League stopped them from making an emergency loan signing, forcing him to recall some 20-year-old kid named Elvis, who was on loan at Borehamwood. Yes, his name really is Elvis. Warnock says it's a case of double standards, since City were allowed to make an emergency signing a few years back. Paddy, you and Neil Warnock have been intimate friends for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Are you going to stick up for your podiatrist buddy?
Nope. I'm going to gently, and I hope he never finds out about this, I'm going to gently correct him. In my opinion, I think it's good that the Premier League enforce very strictly their rules on loan signings. Whatever they did a few years back, and I don't remember, they're doing the right thing now. That's what kids are for. That's what your youth players are for, to play when your senior ones aren't available. I think it's good. Well done, Premier League, I say.
Well done, yeah. That's it. Isn't there somebody who's done this 3 or 4 times? It's right, just an aside. Sorry, Skinner, don't get angry. Who's actually not put a reserve goalkeeper on the bench? Isn't there some manager who's done it a bunch of times this year?
Yes.
Who
doesn't put a reserve goalkeeper on the bench?
I thought it was Warnock.
I think it was Warnock.
It was
Warnock, right?
Yeah.
Good old Neil, huh?
So that's double standards, isn't it?
Sunderland take an early lead against Wigan, but it's all for naught as Franco Di Santo's late winner condemns them to their sixth defeat of the season. Some are already calling for Steve Bruce's head. Alison, is it right to stick with Brucey? And if so, is it right to do so because he's a nice man or because he's a good manager?
Well, they haven't just started calling Steve Bruce's head, have they? There's been discontent there for a while. And the problem is it's become a vicious circle. They're not just saying Bruce out, the fans, they're being abusive about him now, and you can tell it's getting to Bruce. And the minute the manager starts saying things like, if it helps, then I'll go, that's an entrenched position. I think it's really hard to come back from that, to be honest. So, heads are down, and he was given money, he brought in players, there's been no discernible change in level of play or ambition on the pitch. And I hate saying a manager should go, but it does feel like he's about to go.
Okay, Alison, now imagine I'm Steve Bruce. Should I resign, Alison?
I think you'll be happier if you resign, Steve.
Thank you.
Gab, one for you. Barcelona lost for the first time in 28 matches at the weekend, 1-0 at Getafe. Say it ain't so, but I'm going to ask you, is it all falling apart for Pep Guardiola?
Well, it's not good because Real Madrid obviously won and they've got a 6-point margin. And of course, the Clásico on December 12th is at the Bernabeu. That said, I don't think Barcelona played that badly. Messi was ordinary by his standards, but they did have a lot of the ball. They played against an opponent who put nine guys in the 6-yard box. Kind of makes you wonder why that kind of defense doesn't work more often against Barcelona. They've got some guys out, Iniesta, Cesc Fabregas, and so on, but I don't think it's quite, all hands to the pump just yet. That said, it does ratchet up the pressure for the Clásico. Lose that 9 points, then it becomes really, really tricky to get back into it. That's all we've got time for this week. Thanks for joining us on this sad, sad week. You can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, your web chats. You can also follow us all on Twitter. Thanks for joining us this week. Hope you can make it next week. Till then. Bye-bye.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.